Okay, welcome back, everyone. I just want to make a quick announcement, just thank everybody for your participation. One of my favorite reasons for giving this series, actually giving it to people, is that I get feedback. It's also helpful, the people who listen virtually and then email me back. Anyone listening, you can, please do email me. And it's been very helpful. So I encourage you just to continue with the feedback. It helps me clarify my thoughts on these issues. Okay, so the same introduction I've said both weeks. So now I'll say it for the third time. That normal halacha, as far as, you know, the way I usually categorize it, balances three essential factors. Understanding of canonical texts, reliance on precedent, and then the third factor is custom. So what we did in the first 2 weeks, the first week, we analyzed a question within the issue of canonical texts. To what extent Chumash, Navi, Ksuvim, Tanakh is continuing to be a normative source of law. Last week, we dealt with the role of precedent, why the Gemara gained the status that it did, why the Mishnah gained the status that it did, and precedent in general. And this week, I want to touch on one topic within Minhag, specifically an area that people think about the most in the context of Minhag, but actually halachically is probably the least based, which is that of Minhag Avot, family Minhag. So when we're talking about Minhag, I put a little list here at the beginning, but when you think of the word Minhag of custom, without even looking at my list, right, what things do you include in it, right? What issues, what types of minhag, who has minhagim, why are they binding, right? What comes to mind when you think of custom? Yes?
How many hours you wait after eating meat?
Right, so that's the custom that, you know, whenever someone gets married, the first thing they ask, right? My wife asked me, like when we were dating, how many hours do you wait? I told her, I've been a vegetarian since I was six. You can do whatever you want. But her family also waited six, so it didn't make the slightest bit of a difference. But that type of minhag normally comes from, right, people from their family, but everyone knows, especially in that one, from their father's side. And where does the minhagim generate from? We all know it's
part of the world,
right? We know, right? People from Holland love the 1 hour. The assistant rabbi of my shul growing up, his father was the chief rabbi, was the commuting chief rabbi of Amsterdam. So he loved telling us about his days growing up, where he had ice cream right after his Shabbos meal. They would schmooze a little bit in the middle, and then he'd have ice cream. But what that highlights is two minhagim, right? One is minhag of the family. Well, actually, three issues we're going to touch on. One is minhag of family. Two is minhag hamakom, is minhag of the place, or really ethnicity. So that's really three. And the fourth issue that we're also going to touch on is the question of why did we come to the point that we do now, where we assume that wives take the minhag of their husbands. We're going to discuss all of those, right? So those are four issues already within minhag, right? Minhag of place, minhag of a, sort of an ethnic origin, minhag of family, and then the what happens to minhag when one gets married. We're going to get to it in a minute. I'm just highlighting it now. Now, minhag for what? Right? So we talked about the origin of minhag, but minhag for what? In that case, right, that's a minhag where the Gemara has some sort of ambiguous rule that we should separate milk and meat, but it's not exactly clear how much you weigh, and there's a machlokas. So we have a machlokas about how we interpret the Gemara. Well, what types of minhagim do we have? We have minhagim like that, where it's within halacha, sort of, right? What other types of minhagim do we have?
Sitting or standing for kiddush.
Right, so we have, you know, minhagim of how to do mitzvot, right? How to do, right, within halachot. Then we have minhagim that are...
Gebrachs,
not gebrachs. We have things that are not about how to paskin on something, but is a right an added chumrah and a later addition. Right, all types of minhagim. So I want to try to get a little bit of a picture of it, and we're going to come back to this issue of why I'm distinguishing the minhag of place, family. Right, we're going to get to all that. So if you look at my list here, I just put it right. Different minhagim. I think we can potentially talk about. So first of all, we have minhag hamakom, the custom of the place, minhag avot, family custom, minhag ha'edah, which I call the custom of the ethnic group, which I mean Ashkenazi, Sephardi, Hasidish, Litvish, etc., and minhag Yisrael, right? That's, we don't usually think of it as minhag, but that's minhag too, where all of Klal Yisrael has a custom, but it's not actually halachic, right? It's a custom. And then we have different types of customs. We have non-halachic customs, right, where everyone understands this is not a halachic issue, but we have a custom to do it, right? Whatever that could be. That could be things that we call minhag, but we all understand is not a real minhag, right? My minhag is to always be rushed Erev Shabbos on the way to shul, right? That's a minhag kavua, but right, that's not a halachic minhag, but what?
More of a habit.
It's a habit, you know, but whatever, you know. But we have, you know, non-halachic customs. You know, this is how my family does the Seder, right? Where we understand there's value to it, but it's not halachic. No one would say you're doing it wrong, but, you know, one of my Rosh Yeshiva, his minhag is always to have the Seder on couches, Rav Meidan. Yes, exactly.
You don't need that. It's amazing.
What?
It's amazing.
You do it?
Yes. Yeah.
There we go. There we go. I know my father said that the assistant rabbi in his shul was giving a shiur on lighting Shabbos candles, and someone raised her hand and said, my minhag is to light 64 Shabbos candles every Shabbos. We couldn't think of any halachic basis for it, but that's what people do. Then there are, category two is mistaken customs, also a type of custom. But speaking of gebrachs, the riskers tend to think that's where that one goes, but right, there are other ones. And then there's what we mentioned in the beginning, customs to rule in accordance with a particular position. So I want to focus on primarily is minhag avot. Because when we talk about minhag, in the modern world, people tend to think minhag of their family. Right? We don't talk about minhag hamakom, but the irony of that is that halachically, historically, minhag of the family is by far the least based of all minhagim. And according to, as we will see, the vast majority of poskim doesn't really exist, or at least doesn't exist as a halachic category. There are poskim who think it does, but we'll see that it's not at all obvious where we get it from. So let's start with source one. The paradigmatic case of minhag in the Gemara is what we call minhag hamakom. And this is from the fourth perek in Psachim, the perek makom shenahagu, the entire perek ends up being about minhagim. The perek starts with the custom that existed in certain places to not work on Erev Pesach. Right? They treated it as a chag, so they didn't do malach on Erev Pesach. So then the Gemara says, "Haholech mimakom she'osen l'makom she'enosen." Let's say you live in a place where they don't do malacha, they don't work on Erev Pesach, and then you go to a place that they do. Or the other way around. I mean, makom shein osin, la makom sheosin. So no ha, no sinan alav chomre makom sheyatzim isham, the chomre makom shehalach lisham. We give him the stringencies of the place he left and the stringencies of the place to which he comes. Now, that is assuming that he is going back to where he's coming from, or at least the way most poskim understand it. It's a machlokas in the Rishonim, but the simplest understanding is, as I just said, this is assuming he's going back to his original place. We make him be machmir on both, be stringent on both, al yishana adam mipnei hamachlokas. Now, what is the category of minhag that the Mishnah is clearly talking about? Who generated the minhag? What group? What social group?
Place.
Right? Minhag hamakom. Where it becomes tricky is this Gemara. The next two lines in Gemara is where the whole discussion starts. Bnei Beishan, so translate that. Bnei Beishan are the what of Beishan? So people or?
Sons.
Or sons. What's the difference between those two translations, which are both possible? Right? Bnei Beishan, the people of Beishan, means Beishan is a?
Place,
and then this is like the Mishnah. If you think it's the sons of, then what? Who might Beishan be? Not a place, but
a person.
In which case, what might we be talking about?
Family
minhag. But that's the question. Now, the simplest understanding is, as Dr. Friedman said, Bnei Beishan is a place. But let's see. So the Gemara says Bnei Beishan, the people or children of Beishan, Nahug Dilave Azlin Mitzud Letzidon B'Malei Shabbata. They had a minhag that on Friday they wouldn't travel from Tyre to Sidon, right? From Tsur to Sidon, because they didn't travel on Fridays. That was their minhag. Asu binayu kamei de Rabbi Yochanan. The children, let's say, okay, the second generation. Let's put it that way. The second generation. This will, both translations will work. They came in front of Rabbi Yochanan and Amru lo. So they said, Avasin, Efshar lehu, anan lo efshar lan. Our parents, or generation one, was capable of maintaining this custom, but we can't handle it. So do we have to keep it? Right? We need to be able to travel. Amar lehu, he says no. Kvar kiblu avaseichem aleim. Your fathers, generation one, already accepted it. Shneemar, shma bini musar avicha v'al titosh tarasi mecha. As it says, hear, my son, the instruction of thy father, and forsake not the teaching of thy mother. Yes?
It seems awfully strict. Like, what if his father's custom, let's say, to polish his shoes every...
So we'll come to that, right? There's a lot of questions, right? So just look at this text, right? Looking at this text, what questions do we have? So first of all is, if I reformulate your question, to whatever extent this is binding, what gets included in these minhagim that are binding? Right? Does it apply to everything, or is it a certain type of minhag? Right? The next question is also, as we said, who are we talking about? Are we talking about a minhag hamakom? Are we talking about children? Now, what hints do we have here? What hints do we have of whether B'nai Beishan are people, or B'nai Beishan are, is a family or a place? What hints do we have? Right, so that's a little bit ambiguous, right? Benayu, it could either, right? It literally means son, so it could be either. But what, right?
If they're going from Tyre to Sidon, aren't they from Tyre?
Right, so they're talking about people traveling, but they're, well, right, interesting. Right, that maybe if they are from Beishan, right, but they're right, if they're a family of Beishan, they live in Sur, interesting. That might, interesting. Right, that they might live in Sur and not in Beishan, interesting. Now, from the Mishnah, right? Remember, the Gemara is building on the Mishnah. The Mishnah, what category were we clearly talking about? Place. Right? So that would push us towards assuming this is place. But what's the pasuk that we quote?
Shema
b'ni musar avicha v'al titosh tarasi mecha. Don't leave your father and mother's teachings, which at least at first glance sound like?
Family.
Could be family. Right? So, but this is the text where we start with. Whether or not there is such a thing, and what is, right, is there such a thing as family minhag? What are we talking about? So, there are those who look at this and say, yes, this is in fact the source. The Mishnah teaches us that there's a thing called minhag hamakom, that there is a place minhag, but there's also something based on this Gemara as family minhag. Some people try to be medayiket, to pull it out of the words of the Ravid in 4, where the Ravid writes like this: Im kiblu osa al atzman levad yicholim habanim lishanoso. If they accepted it on themselves only, then the fathers can change. Then the children can change the custom. Im lo nagu bo achremises aviyem. They don't carry it on after the death of their father. Im nagu bo kvar kibluhu v'shuvein matir nosovein nishalan lo. But if they had already acted like their father, they'd followed the custom, then it is binding. We'll come back to that point of keeping it after the death of the father, but some people try to read into the Ravid that he's talking about an actual family. It's not clear, because the Gemara itself uses the language of fathers and sons, but it's not clear whether that means actual family, fathers and sons, or members of the place. But if you look, for example, in the Pre-Tawar in 5, he says clearly Pre-Tawar is the Arachayim. He says, "Olam b'nei Beishan he b'nei mishpachas Beishan kipshuta. B'nei Beishan are really members of the Beishan family, literally." So there are those who look at this Gemara and say that there is such a thing as a binding minhag hamakom, one, from the Mishnah, and two, there's something called family minhag, which is also binding. Okay? Yes.
Important at all to know what the grandfather did, because where is his father's custom coming from the heir he's deciding to,
and that we will also get to, right? But presumably yes he's actually getting it from thin air. Well, not thin air, but he's not getting it from, necessarily from his father. Okay, but while this is a possible read of the Gemara in Psachim, again, the vast majority of poskim don't read it that way. For many reasons. One of them is source 6. Source 6 is a Gemara in Chulin. In the context of, as we mentioned before, waiting between meat and milk. That is the context, right? It is one of the paradigmatic contexts. Not just us, but that's the first thing we think of. The Gemara also did. So the Gemara in Chulin Kufay says as follows. Amar Ukva. Mar Ukva said, Ana, In this matter, I am as vinegar is to wine compared with my father. The ilu abba, my father, kavi achel bisra ha'idna, when he would eat meat, lo avi achel gvina ad limachar ad hasha. He wouldn't eat dairy for 24 hours. Tomorrow, now. The ilu ana, but I, behas udasa hudalo achilna. In the same meal, I don't eat meat and milk. The sudasa achrisa, but the next meal, achilna, I do. And Amar Shmuel, Shmuel says, Anna, loha milsa, in this regard, chalav archamra lagabe abba, I'm vinegar, the son of wine, compared to my father. Dilu abba, my father, have a sire nichse trezimna biyoma, vana lo sayarna lechada zimna. My father used to inspect his property twice a day, I would only do it once a day. The point in this Gemara, though, is that you clearly have a case where the father did something and his son didn't. From here, many poskim argue that it's clear that the Gemara in Pesachim must have meant not a family minhag, but a minhag of a place, because you see that the minhag that your parents accept don't count. Right? They're not binding. And if you look, for example, in 7, this is how the Rivash, and the Rivash himself is building on the Ramban. Right? These are two big names. Right? Ramban being leading Rishon in. Where's the Ramban from? Right, where in Spain?
Barcelona.
He's from Catalonia, Girona, right, that area. Right, and Rivash is North Africa. Leading Posek in North Africa, slightly later, Talmud of the Ran. And he writes as follows, Elokol b'nei ya'ir b'chal takanasan. Right, if a city sets up a decree, all the members of the city are within their decree. The af anoladim lachar mikan, and even the next generation is bound. Share yecholim atzibor lasos takan aleim bialzaram, because a community can make a decree on themselves and their children. Because of Ramban Zal, the Ramban said shafilu bidvarim shel kiblu aleim bnei ha'ir behaskama, even things that they didn't accept. They did not agree to formally. Even if the first generation simply acted in a certain way, to make a protection around the Torah, the children are also obligated. Elavadai, however, now the key language, b'nei ha'ir, the members of a city, yicholim l'takin aleim v'aldores habayim. The members of a city can set up a decree for themselves and the future generations. And the Rivash is clear that even when he says Av and Ben, father and child, what he means is b'nei ha'ir. Now, it's slightly cheating, because why might the Rivash and the Ramban not have articulated the difference between minhag ha'makom and minhag ha'avot? Because, let's ask the other way. Why am I articulating? Why is it so clear to me that there's a difference in these, and not so clear to the Ramban, and potentially not clear to the Ramban and the Rivash? Because they didn't travel as much. Right? People stayed in the same place for generation after generation. Right? If you ask, like when I talk to my friends who are Syrian or are Egyptian, right, this doesn't enter their mind, because right, I had one student in Gush who was on one side, he was, I think, from Lebanon, the other side he was from Syria, and his mother was 82nd generation, and they had documents proving their lineage in Syria since Shlomo HaMelech. Right, so they hadn't moved in. Right, the community in Syria claims that the shul there was built by Yoav ben Tsruya, David HaMelech's general. Right, they haven't moved in a very long time. Right, I don't know if it's actually true, but you can't say that about the Bayit. Right, it's a little bit. Right, I mean, Alan was telling me, right, he remembers when the Bayit was farmland. Right, but traditionally people didn't move quite that much, so the difference between ear and family wasn't so much, because, you know. And it didn't come up so much if you were marrying someone from a different town, because you really didn't, right? In Ashkenaz, you have all these fun shilas where people say, I don't understand, how is anybody supposed to get married in whatever town in France, everybody in the town is related. There are no kosher witnesses in the whole city. So people just stayed and stayed and stayed, and they inmarried and they inmarried, right? So a lot of these questions didn't really come up. They're modern shilas. But despite that, the assumption is that when the Rivash and the Ramban say that the category is B'nai Ha'ir, they mean it. They mean that the paradigmatic category in Minhag is not family, it's place. And if this wasn't clear enough in the Rivash, look at 8. I'm just going to give you, just to see, a range, right? Chavos Yair, this is Europe, this is Rav Yair Bachrach, writing in the 1700s, I think, right? He says, "V'nir l'fiyani is daiti divadai krad deshama deshma b'ni musar avicha hu asmachta ba'alma." He says, first of all, the pasuk is just an asmachta; it's not actual a rule from the Torah. It's a nice mnemonic. V'hol dasina lahachi yesh lomer the davka kabbalas rabim b'kihila dekavu yachad. And it seems to me the only type of custom that's binding is that which is accepted by a community. And why did Rabbi Yochanan tell the Bnei Beishan that they had to follow their father's minhag? Because it was a place. Pischei Tshuva in 9. And this is one of the most prominent Mefarshim on Shulchan Aruch. We can argue exactly who's the most prominent, but we're up there in, you know, one of the top 5 that people will look at when they're trying to figure out practical halacha. Pischei Tshuva quotes the Chavos Yair, and he adds from the Tshuva Zichron Yosef in 9, Ein haben mechuyav lihisnaig bahanagas aviv zulas mashisnaig gam haben me'ashehigdil. A child does not have to follow the custom of his father's, but now he puts an important caveat, right? Besides for those that the son was accustomed to after he became an adult. Right, a son doesn't have to take on his father's customs, but if he did, so then he's obligated not because his father was, but because he himself did it. Problem, slight problem, is what if the, right, normally we say that that's true unless you accepted it by mistake. Let's say you thought you had to accept your father's minhag and you didn't, right, then it wouldn't help. Right, I actually had the Shaila last year where I was asked to be part of a Beis Din to nullify someone's, to be matir someone's neder of kitniot, because it was mistakenly thought his father was a Baal Tshuva and his mother was Svardi, and they always ate by his mother's family and his father had no minhag, right? Because his father, right, had lost his minhag, you know, several generations ago, but was in theory Ashkenazi, and someone in high school had told him that, oh, you can't eat kidney yolk because you're Ashkenazi, like, originally. Which the poskim say is really not true. Like, if you're a Baal Tshuva, your grandfather or great-grandfather shouldn't have changed his minhagim if he did, right? It's over. There's no going back to it. And under the circumstances, it was pretty clear, and several poskim told him that he could get a Beis Din together, but they were too busy to actually run the Beis Din, so I had to run it, right? And in that case, the reason that we were matir it was because toes. It was a mistake, right? He thought he had to be bound by it, and he didn't have to be bound by it, and therefore we were matir it. Yeah.
So knowing this, it's a family with a whole bunch of sons. They each come to bar mitzvah, and they go over this line, and they say, you know what, let's make a list now. What do you want to keep and what you don't want to keep? And each brother is doing something different because they're going to make a decision. Isn't that a little bit chaotic?
Possibly, and we'll come back to ancillary concerns like that. Or if you want, we can jump to it, right? There are those, right, who say that who agree fundamentally with what I just said, that is not binding midin minag, and we haven't even talked about why minag is binding, but it's not binding midin minag, whatever that reason is. But maybe, all things being equal, you should tell kids to follow their parents' minags for kibbut aveim, right? Not because it's binding in the same way, or if you jump, for example, to 23, Siyuch Nachum is Toronto facts here, right? Trivia. This is Rav Nachum Rabinovich. Right, currently the Rosh Yeshiva Mala Dumim, but previously the Rabbi of
Clan Park.
Right. So he writes, with all customs like this, a person must take into account his family and friends. So he shouldn't be sitting amongst the standers or standing amongst the sitters. He's a nira kiyuara. It looks arrogant. Umevi lariv ulazus fasayim, and leads to strife and gossip. Biglal hamitan harikshish beinyan, because of the emotional element involved. Ani morel lekol shoel lasos kamo sheosa aviv kedesh lelavazes is aviv rachmana litzlan. I tell everyone to do what his parents did, what his father did, to not embarrass his father. Vafilu aviv mochel. Even his father forgives it, v'gadol kavod aviv, and great is the honor of your father. So he says, even if this is all true, all things being equal, I would tell you, you know, kavod for your parents, keep your father's minhagim. But that's a separate concern, right? That's not binding the way people normally think about minhag, right? People think that there's more to it. Yeah?
But sitting amongst the standards and standing amongst the sitters...
He's pulling on a...
It sounds like when in Rome, do as the Romans.
It's a Gemara phrase for when in Rome, do as the Romans, yes.
It's different because then you come to shul and your father had a minhag. But if everybody's sitting in this place, you don't want to look arrogant and stand. You're not following your father's custom. You're following what's there. That's almost like two... Tell you to do two different things.
So if you continue, I'll have to skip around. I'm hoping I know my own makaras well enough to be able to skip. Or I hope I even put this, actually. I might have taken it out. It's the previous one. So 22 is Ramosha's response to that. Ramosha says, let's say you're in a yeshiva, which has different minhagim than your father's house. When you're at home, so then act like your father. When you're in yeshiva, do like the yeshiva. So yes, right? If once you're talking not midin, minog, not binding minog, but you're talking kavod and things like that, then yeah, you're going to end up in a situation sort of like what you're saying, when in Rome, do as the Romans, which means 90% of the time, do what your family does, and if you're in a situation where there's clearly a counter minog, so don't, because you have to take into account what they do. Well, maybe it's worth saying it now. Okay. But that's not why minog is binding. Minog isn't binding because of those reasons. Why is minog binding? The simplest understanding, why is minhag binding? According to the way most poskim understand it, is one word, neder. It is a form of a vow, right? I sort of gave that away when I said I was matir neder to get rid of somebody's minhag. Simen reisha dalet in Shulchan Aruch assumes that the reason minhag is binding is because it is a vow, and we all know this from Hataras Nedarim, right? Because we say, I am being matir. Anything I accepted, blush and edge, blush and shua, the call, right?
Kol
divrei, anything good that I've done three times, whether I accepted it with the language of a neder or not, the implication is I accepted it as a neder. That is the standard assumption in poskim, that the reason it's binding is me din neder.
No verbalizing.
Correct. With no verbalizing, that we assume that it generates the same effect. And then the poskim get into, and I don't think I put the sources here, exactly when it happens. Do you need to do it three times? Or is it you need to do it three times or one time with the intent to accept it as your minhag? Right? Meaning, sometimes people say, okay, I've accepted it as my minhag without verbalizing it. But in their heart, they've said, okay, this is my minhag, and this is the first week I'm doing it. Or you might not need three. And there's all types of different ways of doing it. But the assumption that it works, midin, neder, we'll see the implication of that in a minute. But just one more source. So far we saw medieval sources, and then we saw Ashkenazi sources that said that minhag is primarily police-oriented. Now let's look at Sephardi. Right, 10, pre-chadash, just so we cover the entire gamut, so that you see this is not limited to Ashkenazim, Sephardim, Rishonim, Achronim. Across the board, you find it. So this starts generally in the Achronim in a discussion of the Bas HaMelech, who is a Rav in Italy. So again, we're really getting the whole, it's Rabbi Yosef ibn Ezra. And the Prichadosh in 10 says, Al kol panim adin pashut, she'ena ben chayav lihinog, se'agim u'gderot aviv ahu d'b'nei beishan, shanayah hi d'b'nei beishan, eino shem ish, el shem makom d'haino beit shan. A father does not pass on his minhagim to his child. The reason they kept it in beishan is because it was a place, not a family. And if you want some big names who line up in 20th century behind this position, or 19th and 20th century, actually I put here, but let's start with 20th century. Reb Moshe Feinstein, Reb Avadia Yosef, right? Those are big names in Ashkenaz and Sfarad, right? In Israel and in America. The Rav Palim, also poskens this way, which is the Ben Ish Chai. So leading posig of Eidut HaMizrach of the previous century, and Mordechai Eliyahu in general always poskens like the Ben Ish Chai. So we're talking really big names who assume that this is the case. Another one, 12, the father of the Rambam. Minag is Minag Hamakom, and there is no source in the Gemara for Minag Avot. Minag Avot, no such thing, right? We talk about it all the time, never happens, right? It's a little bit more complicated, we'll see that in a minute, but that is their halachic assumption based on this Gemara. What do they do with the Pasuk? Right, so either they do what the Chavos Yair said.
Are you just explaining the Gemara, or are you saying that that's a general statement?
No, that is both their reading of the Gemara and their halachic statement. That is their halachic assertion. We will complicate that in a minute. But
because what happens if you have minik amakom, you have minik avos. You don't have minik amakom. According to what you're saying.
And we will come back. We're going to complicate it. Things always get more complicated. But just one more point, and then we'll get to questions. I just want to read. I want to read just two more sources, and then we'll get to questions. So, what do you do with the pasuk, which sounds like it's talking about family? So either you say it's an asmachta, like the Chavos Yair, or you interpret it differently. So if you look, for example, in 12, this is from Maimon, as in the father of Rambam, Rabbi Moshe ben Maimon. He says, "Va'osam aminhagos ein lanu livazosam." We shouldn't degrade customs. Umishin higam zariz umishtadelhu. And those who developed the custom showed alacrity and effort. Kihim meikarim nasim. They are made from essential values. Vol yavozu b'minhag ha'uma. And do not degrade the customs of the nation. Ukvar amar ha'navi. Alav ha'shalom. And the Navi already said, Al titosh torat imecha. Right? Don't abandon the teachings of your mother. Meaning, dat umatecha. Imecha isn't your mother, it's umotecha. Your your nation, al ta'azov. It's the metaphoric ima, it's the metaphoric mother, it's the nation. It's, right, mother Israel, it's mother earth, mother whatever, right? It's the metaphoric aim, it's it's nation. Now, while I think it's true that the majority of poskim say what I just said, there are very prominent poskim who say not like what I just said, such as in 13, Yosef Shalom Al-Yashiv writes not this way. He says, "V'gam yachid shekiba l'latzman agatova reizim mechayiv ezaro dachziv al titosh taras imecha." If a father accepts a good custom, it obligates the children, because it says, "Do not abandon the teachings of your mother." El shekola chadeinu tzarech levar kol hanhagas aviv leino kamoso. But now he puts a caveat. He said, it's not everything your father did. It's a certain type of minhag, and this comes back to your question, is, he says, even if you think that your father's minhagim are binding, so he still has to deal with the Gemara in Chulin, which says that, right, who was it again? Mar Ukva didn't wait 24 hours between milk and meat. So he says, it's very simple. There are minhagim your father accepts, planning for it to be the family minhag, and there are minhagim that he accepts to be his minhag. If he accepted it for himself, it doesn't bind you. If he accepted it for the family, it does. And he says, "Vilino kimo so rag mashakibel gamal zarachra." Of those things he accepted for himself and his family.
So would that include anything that's beyond the halacha? Knows if you go back to, let's say, to the 6 hours. At the end of the day, wherever you fall on the side of the poskim, whether it be 6 hours, there's nobody that holds 24, and none of them shown him actually come to 24.
Oh, for sure. I mean, that was a chumrah yisera.
Correct. So one could learn that's what Marukva's father did.
And we're going to come back, right?
And that for sure he doesn't have to take on. So it's not a
correct. And as we said, right, when we ask the minhag question, it's complicated because first we have to figure out the origin, and then we have to figure out what type of minhag is it. So far we only talked about origin, but we're going to come soon to all of your points, right? So just hold on. Don't worry. We will get to sources that will cover all those things, and we'll see that there's different types of minhagim. Yeah.
Just to understand this thing about keep the minhag of the makom, when we have an ingathering of exiles, and they're coming from here, they're there, and they're starting up a new settlement town. What does it mean then?
Hold all these thoughts, because that's what's going to complicate all of this. Yes, Aaron.
I mean, if you take, like, Rosh has a very literal understanding of the pasuk, Musar, Vichar, Nal, Pesach, Toras, Anacha, but, like, if you're taking it literally, doesn't that mean Toras, Anacha, that's your mother, not your father?
Well, it's the whole pasuk. I assume. I assume he means the whole pasuk, and he means father and mother. I'm just guessing, which is what he seems to assume halachically.
Like, equates them. So if you're learning the halacha from there, doesn't the mother have to say it?
I would say yes, but we'll get back to that when we get to spouse. You know, who takes the which minhag? Because we'll get to that. We will get to that. But I assume, and if we don't get to it, or you know, you have to run. For that one, because I was running out of space, I just put an article that summarizes it. So it's not even like I have to, you know. Okay, fine. So let's complicate the picture. Let's see one more source that seems to go in this direction. Actually, no. Let's continue. Okay. Now let's assume for a second that it is binding. The minhag of your parents or the minhag of the makom is binding. Well, how binding is it? So let me ask you a very simple question. If minhag is binding because of neder, so, how could one get out of all minhagim even if they were binding? Hataras nedarim. Is there any reason to assume that that would not be true? That minhag is more powerful than neder, and that even though your father, no one argues, could have been matir, that, let's say your father started the minhag, he could have gotten rid of it through hataras nedarim, you can't. So at first glance, I would say, probably not. But that didn't stop a lot of poskim from saying yes. And it's not exactly clear why, but there are many poskim who think this is in fact the case. For example, the Marash Dam, and this is quoted as well in the Chasam Sofer in 14, says, Mikol den nira li ikra ledina denehi dehem atzmim yichol ma'atir. The fathers could have nullified it, mikol makom b'neim ein lahem hetir, but the children cannot. So they actually say that somehow magically, the minhag becomes more binding on the children. Now, the explanation that I've seen given is that the reason you're able to be mater neder, you can nullify a vow, is because you're undoing what you said. But if you didn't initiate the neder on yourself, then you also can't uninitiate the neder. But it's a little bit interesting that your father could have gotten out of it. Your father was the one who accepted it, and you can't. Now, there are poskim who say it, but I think here again, the majority of poskim think that this is not the case. If you look, for example, in the Pri Chadash in 15, the Pri Chadash says, Rav mi Mari Kolon, Svir le dafla avin lavatara. He says the Mari Kolon went farther. He denied it. He said the father can't be matter anyways. When you accept a chumrah on yourself, it's stronger than a neder. You can never get out of it. But the Pri Chadash says that's not normative psak. He says, but from the Mari Kolon you do see one thing. The Mari Kolon suggests this for the father, but he says that maybe the father can't get out of it, but the children can, and maybe even the father can. He doesn't like it. But he says what you see from the way he phrases it is the exact opposite of Marash Dam, is that he says it's not that the sons are more bound to it. To whatever extent you think the father's bound to it, the kids are obviously less bound to it because they didn't accept the neder. And again, if we're working with the neder model, it makes a lot of sense. The most bound person is he who actually accepted the neder. So again, there are those who think that minhag is more binding than neder and the children can't get out of it, but there are those, and I think this is normative, who think this is not the case. You actually can get out of it. Yeah?
Does it matter if the child would like to do something more stringent versus doing something less stringent?
Probably, so because he could add a stringency if he wanted to.
Okay, so and what if something is ambiguous? Like what you talked about initially about not working Erev Pesach, is that a stringency or is that a privilege? Because you can think of it either
way. So there the Gemara assumes it's a Chumrah. Right? The Gemara assumes...
It's not so clear.
Correct, but the Gemara presents it as such. I mean, we could have, you know, we could equivocate about it, but the Gemara, there the Mishnah says that there's those who are Machmer, those who are Mekel, right, and presents it as such.
That's a Yom Tov.
It's a Minhag to treat it as a Yom Tov.
It's a Yom Tov because of a Korban.
Right, but a Minhag to do so. So it's a little bit... Okay.
It's rooted in that.
Yes, yes, yes. Okay. So now... So far what we've talked about is two things, right? One is, do minhag derive from family or from place? And two is, okay, whatever, once a minhag is accepted, can you get out of it? Can the parents get out of it? Can the children get out of it? And we've seen different opinions on all of it. But so far, we've talked about minhagim. We haven't talked about different types of minhagim. So all the minhagim we seem to have been talking about are one very specific type of minhag, which is you accepted a chumrah on yourself, right? An extra halachic chumrah. But there's another type of minhag, which is not an extra halachic one, but it's a minhag to paskin in a certain way, right? That's different, right? There's, we can say everyone agrees that this is not mutter or, right, it's not mutter usr issue. It's, if we accept it, it's a chumrah. And then there's another type of minhag, which is there's a machlokes between the mechaber and the Rama, and the minhag of Ashkenazim is to paskin like the Rama. Right? That's a different type of minhag, which we haven't seen yet. So some people argue that whatever you think about minhag level 1, and getting rid of minhag level 1 of chumrah, which is midin neder, right? It could be that minhag type 2, where you're not accepting a new chumrah, what are you doing? You have a custom to choose like a certain position. Why is it binding? Not because it's a minhag, not because it's a neder, rather a vow, but because it's a psak, right? You're accepting a psak on yourself, and maybe that's more powerful. So if you look in 16, the Pri Chadash raises this possibility. He quotes again the Maharaj Dam. He says, well, here, just look at English here. He says, the Maharaj Dam wrote that they only argue about things that are totally permitted, and they were accustomed to forbid them, which is like a new prohibition. And it must be like a vow, which can be nullified like other vows, which forbid the permitted. However, something that has a dispute concerning it among the scholars, and in one place they're accustomed to follow the words of those who forbid, they did not accept a new prohibition that it should be like a vow, for according to that scholar, it is forbidden. Until here was his position. Right? So he quotes the Maharaj Dam, who says that even if you think you can get out of a minhag through Ataras Nedarim, that's only the type of minhag where you accepted a new stringency. But if you had a minhag to paskin in a certain way, then the Maharaj Dam argues that everybody would agree you could never get out of it. Pri Chadash himself argues, and he says, however, the truth is that this is only if they don't have a rabbi. If they have an established scholar, he can rule leniently. For they only became accustomed like this based on the authority who forbade because they thought the law was like him. Since the rabbi, has proof to contradict that authority, they are only obligated to follow the judge in their days, and they shall travel and camp based on his voice. It emerges that the first custom, based on that authority, is, quote-unquote, a mistaken custom. And I've already written that mistaken customs can be permitted without nullification. He argues, and he says, no. It may be true that when you have a custom to follow a certain position that's different than a minhag to accept a stringency on yourself, so the mechanism getting out of it is different, but the mechanism is not necessarily harder, right? If the minhag was to paskin in a certain way, then what's the solution? How do you get out of a psak? With a new psak, right? So if he had a psak, and now you have a rabbi, and you legitimately have a psak, so then you could get out of the minhag, not through Hataras Nedarim. Maybe you need Hataras Nedarim also, maybe. But you can get out of it simply based on a new psak. So, Maharaj Dam argues that that type of minhag, to paskin in a certain way, is more stringent. And the Pri Chadash argues, okay, yes.
Just to go back to the previous one about the stringency. Say that some of the stringencies are baltosif, like let's say keeping 24 hours, or let's say making havdalah only 5 hours after.
So the assumption of most posting was like the Rambam, that baltosif is only when you keep something, assuming it's a mitzvah d'oraisa, or a biblical mitzvah.
That's what you have in your head?
Well, you present it as such. But if you present it as a chumrah, then you're fine. Right? It's only if you...
It's a fine line. I mean, your behavior is the same.
Correct. Either. It is a very fine line, and it gets really murky in the middle of the 19th century. In the middle of the fights in Hungary and the Psak Din of Michalovce, but until then it's murky and it comes to a fore there with the machlokas between Maram Shik and Rav Hillel Lichtenstein and Akiva Schlesinger, but that's a talk for another time because that's way too complicated. But that's the answer al regal achas. Okay, so then why is it that we all think of minhag avos is the paradigmatic category of minhag? Are we all just mistaken or following, or are we all paskin grib liyashiv? But in general, right, if Moshe Feinstein, Rav Avadya Yosef, and you know, many other very prominent poskim who are alive, not like ancient poskim, but like poskim who actually like ran the halachic discussion in the 20th century, thought not this way, so why do we think differently? And the answer is that there's a different type of minhag we haven't discussed yet explicitly, which is not really minhag hamakom, not really minhag mishpacha, but somewhere in between, which is minhag ha'id, what I would call minhag ha'idah. Right? 90% of the time when we're talking about minhagim of your father, we're not talking about things your father did by himself. We're talking about your father was an Ashkenazi or a Sephardi. So, is that different? Well, it's a little bit complicated. Because where did that minhag come from? What type of minhag is minhag Ashkenaz?
Place.
Yeah, it's a minhag hamakom. What happened when we left Europe, or we left, you know, Arab lands and moved to America, Canada, and Israel, and suddenly we're all mixed together? So, did the minhag of the Eidah follow us? In other words, did minhag hamakom transform into this new category called minhag Eidah? What do you think? We do act that way. Why do we act that way? So, interesting question. So, tell me possibly why. Give me a throw out reasons why it might be binding.
Because your father did.
So it might be that the fact that we treat Ashkenaz and Sfarad as binding proves that really we paskin like all those positions who say fathers, minhagim, are binding.
There's no more makom.
Ah, there's no more makom. So does that make the minhag weaker or stronger?
Weaker.
At first glance, weaker. But why would you say not?
Because now you fall,
to
back on, you fall back on what's left, minhagavos.
Ah, so that is what we have. If we look now at 17... The Pri Chadosh was asked the following question. And this is the, right, before the 20th century, this is a close equivalent. B'nei Yir Achash in Isgarshu v'kavu dirasu magom acher. What if a whole city moves? Right? Now, what are we doing? Now we're testing the waters, right? Because now we're saying, it's not minag mishpacha, but it's not the same makom, but all the people in a place moved. So, it's a kihilah, but it's not a makom. Now what do we do? Right, the kavod dirasan v'makom achar sheyish bem kulos v'chumros mishunos miminag shalahem. Now they move into a new place with a different minag. What's the halacha? Ech yisnagu amigurashin. How do the people who were exiled act? Im kiminag makomam o kiminag b'nei makom shekavod dirasan. New place, old place. So he says like this. Pri Chadosh argues, kol ir chadasha im noda rov ansha meheichan ba'o. If a new city arises and everyone knows where they came from, Hakol kiminag oso makom shabau misham. So if they move into a new place, so then they move into a new place. No Jews there. What minag do they have?
They bring it with them.
So the Pri Chadosh says, first of all, minag makom is not just makom. It can create a ethnic identity if you move into a new city with no minag. But he says, "V'tamei da'avi ir chadasha." That's only if it's a new city. Avam ha'ochu le'ir acheres sheyesh ba'minyan. But if you go to a place that has its own minyan, right? And he means minyan. He means 10 people. It doesn't mean that many people. Afal bisha ba'im he merubim. Even if the people who come in are more numerous, yesh lem din yachid. They're like a single person who moved in. V'chayavin linhok chumrei makom shalchu l'sham. And they have to keep the new chumros of the place they move into. Upaki minayu al chumros enogin bimkoman, and their old chumros disappear.
Wow.
So the Pri Chadosh says, what's the only time that there's such a thing as minhag ha'idah if you move into a
place with only 9 men?
Right, meaning a place with no minhag. But if there's a place with a minhag, even if you're more numerous, minhag ha'idah evaporates. So what's America and Canada? Is it what the Pri Chadosh described?
We don't have...
Yeah.
Depends when.
Right now, 21st century. America, Canada, 21st century.
Based on that, you can't bring, because we have so much diversity.
Well, a little bit murky, because on the one hand, well, it depends. What is the Pri Chadosh really saying? And this is what people aren't sure about. Is he saying that In order to carry a minhag with you, you need to move into a place that has, right, nobody that, no minhag. Or is it that in order to get rid of your minhag, you need to move into a place that has a minhag that will replace yours? Right, so, meaning, if you move into a place that has multiple minhagim, so it depends. If you think that what you need, right, if you think that the only time you can reestablish a minhag is if you move into a void, so then if you have a place with multiple minhagim, do you carry your minhag with you? No, because there are multiple minhagim, and you're not bound by that one, because you can adopt any of the minhagim in the area. If you think that your old minhag only gets uprooted if it gets replaced by an established minhag, so what happens if you move into an America or a Canada that has no established minhag? Can you get rid of your old minhag?
No.
No. So that's 18. So the Pri Chadash himself thinks like possibility one, that the only time that your minhag gets, the only time that you carry on a minhag aida is if you move into a void. But he quotes, let's just look at it inside here, in 18 he quotes the Knesset HaGdola and the Maharit, who say no, that the stringencies of the place they left are not removed until they've established themselves in a city that has a lenient custom, but not a city that has no established custom. And the Sefer Talamarti says what I just said, because he understands it, that it's not that, right? It's that you need to actively uproot your old minhag. But if you move into an America or a Canada or an Israel where there are multiple minhagim, so you fall back on minhag akila, which is sort of minhag hamakom. So even if we don't think there's pure minhag avos, there's possibly, again, it's a machlokes, but there's possibly this notion of minhag eida when you move into a place that has multiple minhagim, because you don't remove your old minhag because you moved as a group. Yeah.
Talk about someone moving here. Do we talk about moving to Canada? Do we talk about moving to Ontario? Do we talk about moving to Toronto? Do we talk about Thornhill?
Yeah, so that I ran out of space for, but that is, Rabbi Lam has an article where he notes that another sort of wrench in this issue is that it used to be very clear what a makom meant, because there was one shul in one city and that's it. Or even if there were multiple shuls, there was one chief rabbi. Now there isn't, so he argues that even if one wanted to look for a minhag hamakom, you couldn't find it because there's no precedent for having a minhag of a shul, right? So you're right. It's hard to establish. He tries to establish it based on a totally different category called minhag asocharim, right? That just like businessmen within a city can create their own monetary customs, a shul, because you pay membership dues to the shul, you've accepted their minhag. But Rabbi Simon critiques it heavily in his book on minhagim and Imrei Baruch. But it remains complicated. It remains complicated. And I'm not trying to solve any issues. I'm just trying to point out that that which we thought that is so obvious to us is really, really, really complicated. So if we just summarize what we're up to right now, the simple category we know exists is minhag hamakom. And that expresses itself in one of two ways. Either in terms of extra stringencies, or two, in terms of a minhag of how to paskin. Whether there is such a thing independently as minhag avos, in terms of the classic categories of minhag, unclear. The majority of poskim think not. What there might be is minhag eida, but also that's a little bit murky, because minhag eida, according to Pri Chadash, will only continue if you move into a place that has no minhag. But if you move into a place with multiple minhagim, it loses its potency, and then you can choose whatever minhag you want in the new place. If you hold like the Knesset HaGdola, so then one would understand why minhag Ashkenaz, minhag Sfarad, minhag Lita, minhag Hasidim, and the like remained in effect when we moved to America, Israel, Canada, because since there were multiple minhagim, none of them could override this thing called minhag Eida, which is a function of minhag HaMakom. But that's a little bit murky. Right, Rav Moshe Feinstein also takes that position, by the way. That Rav Moshe does accept in a different tshuva. But again, it's always a little bit unclear. For example, in Alon Shvut, right, you've been there, right? The shul, does it have a minhag hamakom of how to daven?
Seems that whoever goes up, it's there.
There's a sign. When you go up, If you daven Nusach Ashkenaz, you turn the sign Ashkenaz. If you're Svard, you turn it the other way. We've actively created a scenario where there is no minhag. So can
That's
we?
The minhag.
Right. The minhag is to have no minhag. So is that going to remove previous minhagim? I don't know. Right. It's a situation where we've actively chosen to not impose minhagim. What does that do to minhag? Very unclear. So I'll be honest that my conclusion on this is that I'm not sure. Right. I've presented you with the information that I know, and pointed in directions that Poskim have taken, but the answer is that Poskim are still sort of working it out because the 20th and 21st century look very different than they do historically. I want to just run through some of these sources, then we'll have questions at the end. So I just want to get a few thoughts in. Okay, we did note one other thing, right? We already saw in the Siach Nachum that it's possible that in addition to all the reasons why Minhag might be formally binding, we have the other issues of Kibud Av V'Em and the like. I want to just flesh out a little bit more this issue of Minhag in Psak. So Minhag in Psak is actually a very old tradition. If you look in 19, I'll summarize it here. So basically, the Gemara has a different type of category, which is not identical to Minhag HaMakom, but it's similar in certain ways, which is called Mara D'Asra, right? That a Rav of a town is the binding posek of the entire city. And that is not Minhag HaMakom, but it's the Psak HaMakom. The Rajba introduces that by his time already, if you just look at the bolded part, he says, U'min aderech hazeh, as a legal expansion, I would just add that in, right? As a legal expansion of the concept of Mara D'Asra, of local community rabbi, this was the way that we began the tradition already in the middle, right, in the medieval period, to say that Svardim Paskin like the Rambam. So there's another element, which is in addition to Minhag, right, there's another thing going on, which is Minhag Ha'eda is an expansion of a different category also. It's not just pure Minhag, it's an expansion of Mora D'Asra, where, as Rilchenstein phrases it, we moved from geographic Mara D'Asra to ideological Mara D'Asra. And it could be that we created Minhag Ha'eda not through the normal path of Minhag, but through a Minhag-esque expansion of Mara D'Asra from local authority to ideological pillar of a community. Right, and you see it as well, the Urim Betumim in 20 describes that this is what happened with Shulchan Aruch and Ramah. That the sages of the generations accepted and established to guard and do all that was said in the short formulation of Shulchan Aruch and Ramah. In my opinion, there is no doubt that this is all from God and was successful through their hands, for many questions were asked by the Achronim, and they were answered with acuity and depth. And 21, Rabbi Avadya Yosef says this as well. It is known. What?
He hasn't seen the Shach, the Taz, and everything else.
He says in general, right? In general. It is known that the Achronim, right? There are obviously exceptions to this. Because the exception to Mara D'Asra always is your posek can paskin differently, but as a general rule, as a rule of thumb, right? Rabbi Avadya doesn't take it as a rule of thumb. He took it as psak. We look at 21, right? It is known what the Achronim wrote. Any Svardi who acts like Ramah against Maran needs atonement. It is clear in Shas, and the rulings of the local authority were very powerful. Thus, it is certain that in these lands, where Rambam and Maran are the local authorities, we rule like them, and we cannot move from their words right or left. So there is another possibility that the way we created Minhag Ha'eda is not through an expansion of Minhag HaMakom, but is through an expansion of the category called Mara D'Asra, where we went from identifying local authorities to identifying ideological authorities. Okay, I want to make a few more points. Can we hold questions to the end? I know there's a lot of questions, and I will stay after until as many issues as we can possibly resolve are resolved. But that, I think, is just a snapshot of the complexity of our situation and time in the 21st century, right? What should become clear is that while it's clear that we do treat Minhag and Minhag Avot and Minhag Ha'eda and Minhag HaMakom really powerfully, why we do it is a little bit unclear, because Jewish life has changed so radically in the 20th and 21st century that we're dealing with a new situation. So there might not be a great answer, but you see that Poskim are trying to struggle with this sort of innate assumption that minhag must be important. So they're trying to find halachic language for it. They're not exactly clear why it's important, but they're pretty much assured that it is. So what I want to do just quickly is, well, why is it important? Whatever minhag is, whenever it's binding, why is it important in the first place? So here I just gave a few sources. So 24, the Gemara says, Amr lehen halacha zu shamati v'shachachti. Hillel had said, I heard this halacha and forgot it, but had elahanach lehem liyisrael im ein neviim heim b'ni neviim heim. Listen to the Jewish people, because if they're not prophets, they're children of prophets. So many people say, why is it that we assume that minag Yisrael, minag Aida, minag Amakom, minag Avot is important? Because the actions of the Jewish people at some level, right, express prophecy, express God's will. The Rav has a formulation in Nefesh HaRav that history proves the truth or falsehood of our actions. Right? God wouldn't allow, basically, history to develop in a way that was illegitimate. He wants us to be keeping the Torah. So if we're doing it a certain way, there must be some truth to it, and that's why we give it weight. In 25, he phrases it as follows. This is the practical tradition based on the customs of Israel and keeping of the commandments. This is based on the verse, ask your fathers and they will tell you, your elders, and they shall say it to you. Rabbi Yosef Dov, meaning his grandfather, the Beis HaLevi, argued and said that proofs and logic cannot prove anything about the tradition of ask your fathers and they will tell you. There the logic does not decide, but the tradition itself. This is how the fathers acted, were seen, and this is how the children must act. There's something inherently powerful of mimetic tradition, right? There's a certain prophecy, a certain will of God expressed simply through what we do. The Rambam in 26 adds another possibility and says that at least chumros, things that we accept as a minhag to protect the Torah, is actually binding under the pasuk of lo tasur min adavar shayagidu l'chayim in usmol, the same pasuk that binds us to rabbinic law, binds us to those minhagim which were instituted to protect the values of the Torah. So that's just two possibilities of why it is that we take at least certain minhagim very powerfully in halacha. And again, despite the fact that it's unclear to me why minhag Eidah is so powerful, it's clear that the postgame assume that it is. But we're like I said, the language of how we get there halachically is a little bit unclear, but I want at least to show you that this third pillar, right, the poskim are so convinced that minhag is powerful that even when it's not clear that it should be binding anymore, they struggle to find language to explain why it is, because there is that intuition that minhag is really, really powerful. But again, figuring out one minhagim are powerful is really a complicated task, especially in the 21st century. 2 minutes, and I'm not even going to read it inside, on this last question, but I knew this might happen, which is why I gave you a summary at the end, right, in English. Right, so you can look at it in your own time, is the question of why is it that to whatever extent we think minhag avot is binding and minhag aidah is binding, why do we generally go by the husband's minhag? So this actually, kimat does not appear in the medieval period. It appears in one tshuva in the entire medieval period, in the tshuva's Tashbetz, for the very simple reason I said before. People married their cousins and everyone had the same minhagim and they were living in the city, so how often did it come up? But the Tashbetz was asked the question, and he says, in 27, I'll summarize it for you outside, he says that basically, because ishto kegufo, and they become like one, so they can't have multiple minhagim because they end up fighting, and in general, the wife moved into the husband's house, and therefore, they took that minhag. And then he takes it really formally, and he says, I see it, and I'm not gonna leave you hanging here. I'm not gonna leave this as the only, I never leave anything with only one answer, never. It's against, as Ezra Lichtenstein once said, what type of Jew answers a question with a monosyllabic answer? Not the type that I know. And that is my rule in life. And then he says, he has this interesting thing, he proves from Truma. Right, by Truma, if a woman who's not a Kohen marries a Kohen, so while she's married to him, she becomes part of his house and can eat Truma. If he dies and she has children with him, she can continue eating Truma because she remains in his house. If she has no children, she goes back to her father's house. So the Tashbetz uses this as evidence that a woman is part of her husband's house as long as either he's alive or alternatively she has children that continue to make her be related to his house. And that is the Taz Beitz' assumption. The Griz Moshe, Rav Moshe Feinstein and others in 28 argues that it's based on a different model, and he said, look, the paradigmatic category of minhag, as we said, is minhag ha makom. And he said, well, what is your most primary makom? Your house, right? And whose obligation is it to support the house? The husband. So you're moving into his house. And therefore, the reason we go with the husband's minhag in general is a function of minhag ha-makom at some level. And women would generally move to whatever city their husbands were living in. So the tradition developed that you follow the husband's minhagim. Rav Moshe Feinstein himself put a big caveat on this in 29, which is he thinks that this is only minhagim. There are different ways of understanding this, Rav Moshe, but I'll just put one out there. That this is only minhagim that relate to both the husband and the wife. But someone asked him, what if I don't like that my wife wears wigs? I want her to only wear shaitels. Rav Moshe said, 29, it is none of your business. It's her minhag, right? Doesn't relate to you. Be quiet. Right, so Rav Moshe, even though he thought that a wife follows her husband's minhagim, he seems to have limited that to minhagim that relate to both of them, not uniquely to her.
What about cooking? If one of them is doing the cooking...
Well, because he's eating it. Because he's eating it, right? So they're both involved. And Rav Ovadia Yosef also thinks this way, but again, he doesn't always say it, right? He doesn't love Gibrach, so he's like, okay, a wife doesn't really have to accept that one. In general, accept it, but you know, certain minhagim are just like, so just, they're just such chumras, like, that's not Ikra Din. Like, he can do whatever he wants.
He can choose, isn't it? Oh.
Yes, which brings me to the last point, which is, in general, poskim assume, as I just said, but Rav Chaim Jachter asked Rav Yehuda Herzl Henkin, who, of all these poskim, is the only one who's alive at the moment, living in Eretz Yisrael, right, the head of Nishmat, along with his wife, or the posek of Nishmat, his wife's the head, Rabbi Nid Henkin. And Rav Henkin said, he acknowledges, Rabbi Jachter asked this, Shaila, so I'm going to let him talk. You can look at the chuvos inside, but he asked the Shaila, so this is his summary. It says, Rav Yehuda Henkin acknowledges that common practice is to follow Rav Moshe's, Rav Ovadia's, and Rav Felder's rulings. I should have mentioned Rav Felder, because I'm in Toronto. So Rav Felder also poskens that way. Okay. However, Rav Henkin challenges the fundamental assumption of their ruling. This is very clever. Rav Henkin notes the dispute between Rabbeinu Tam and the Rami of Rutenberg regarding when husband and wife come from different places, whether a wife must move to the husband town or vice versa. The Rama and Beit Shmuel rule that the Halacha accepts Rabbeinu Tam's ruling that the husband must move to his wife's town. If the husband must move to the wife's town, observes Rav Henkin, then he will be required to observe the local halachic practices, those of the wife's family. Rav Henkin also asserts that Dvarim 24:1 does not constitute a halachic norm and that the marital home belongs to the husband in a metaphysical sense. It could be that the Torah merely reflects the sociological norm of the time, that the marital home belonged to the husband, and upon divorce he sent her from his home. Rav Henkin argues that the Torah does not preclude the joint ownership by husband and wife of a marital home, both in an economic and metaphysical sense. Rav Henkin concludes that we should not abandon the accepted practice for wives to follow their husband's family traditions. However, he rules that a wife may continue to follow her family's traditions regarding a matter that does not impinge on her relationship with her husband and does not impose a hardship on her. Rav Henkin requires that she stipulate with her fiancé before the marriage that she wants to continue to practice her own family's traditions. For example, this author's wife stipulated that she wanted to continue her family tradition to wait 5 hours between eating milk and meat rather than accepting this author's family tradition to wait 6 hours before eating milk, meat and milk. Rav Henkin wrote to this author in an unpublished response that if the husband is a convert or Baal Tshuva and the wife's family is an unbroken chain of halachic observance, the husband may adopt his wife's family traditions. He writes, though, that it might be more appropriate for the husband to follow the prevalent traditions of the community to which he belongs. Rav Henkin counsels that the husband should seek the guidance of his Rav in choosing the most appropriate approach in this issue. Chaim David Alevi writes that in marriage where the wife is halachically observant and the husband is not, the family should practice the wife's family traditions, and Rav Zalman Nechemiah Goldberg told his author that he agrees with this ruling. So, the standard psak is to say that the minhag generally follows the husband. Rav Henkin assumes that this is not an ironclad rule. It's a rule of thumb. If there's strong opposition to it, so just stipulate before you get married that you're not going to do that and all will be good. And Rav Moshe himself and Rav Avadya both put limitations, even to the extent we accept this. Rav Moshe says, if it's her minhag, leave it to her. Rav Avadya says, things which are just very, very machmir, also pick and choose a little bit. So what comes out is, while there is a rule of thumb that it goes that way, there are poskim who are willing to be a little bit more malleable with it. My own psak on it, I'm not going to say on record. Once we turn it off, we can discuss as much. No, I still have the audio going. But anyways, I hope that gives you a snapshot, at least, of the complexity of minhag. On the one hand, you see how important it is. But on the other hand, right, considering it's the least textual of the three factors, it is also the most murky, which makes sense, which is why the three factors have to work together. But I think that just gives a snapshot of some of the issues, at least, that come up in modern psak regarding